Chapter 17. They had the argument right there on the street as they walked through Georgetown.
"Worried about my safety?"
Negley asked.
"Because you shouldn't be. Nothing's going to happen to me. I can look after myself, and I can make my own decisions."
"I'm not worried about your safety."
"What then?"
"My performance? I'm way better than you." "I know you are."
"So what's your problem?"
"Your license. You got something to lose." Negley said nothing. "You've got a license, right? To be in the business you're in? And you've got an office, and a job, and a home, and a fixed location? I'm going to disappear after this. You can't do that."
"Think we're going to get caught?"
"I can afford to take the risk. You can't."
"There's no risk if we don't get caught."
Now Reacher said nothing.
"It's like you told Bannon. I'm lying there lined up on these guys. I'm going to get an itch in my spine. I need you to watch my back."
"This isn't your fight."
"Why is it yours? Because some woman your brother once dumped got herself killed doing her job? That's tenuous."
Reacher said nothing.
"Okay, it's your fight. I know that. But whatever thing you've got in your head that makes it your fight makes it my fight, too. Because I've got the same thing in my head. And even if we didn't think the same, if I had a problem, wouldn't you help me out?"
"I would if you asked."
"So we're even."
"Except I'm not asking."
"Not right now, but you will be. You're 2,000 miles from Wyoming, and you don't have a credit card to buy a plane ticket with, and I do. You're armed with a folding knife with a 3-inch blade, and I know a guy in Denver who will give us any weapons we want, no questions asked, and you don't. I can rent a car in Denver to get us the rest of the way, and you can't."
They walked on 20 yards, 30. "Okay," Reacher said. "I'm asking."
"We'll get the clothes in Denver. I know some good places."
They made it to Denver before 3 in the afternoon, mountain time. The high plains lay all around them, tan and dormant. The air was thin and bitter cold. There was no snow yet, but it was coming. The runway plows were lined up and ready. The snowdrift fences were prepared. The car rental companies had shipped their sedans south and brought in plenty of new four-wheel drives. Negley signed for a GMC Yukon at the Avis counter. They shuttled to the lot and picked it up. It was black and shiny and looked a lot like Froelich's Suburban, except it was 2 feet shorter. They drove it into the city. It was a long, long way. Space seemed infinitely available, even after D.C., which wasn't the most crowded place in the East. They parked in a downtown garage and walked 3 blocks, and Negley found the store she was looking for. It was an all-purpose outdoor equipment place. It had everything from boots and compasses to zinc stuff designed to stop you getting sunburn on your nose. They bought a bird watcher's spotting scope and a hiker's large-scale map of central Wyoming, and then they moved to the clothing racks. They were full of the kind of stuff you could use halfway up the Rockies and then wear around town without looking like a complete idiot. Negley went for a Walker's heavy-duty outfit in greens and browns. Reacher duplicated his Atlantic City purchases at twice the price and twice the quality. This time he added a hat and a pair of gloves. He dressed in the changing cubicle, left Joe's last surviving suit stuffed in the garbage can. Negley found a payphone on the street and stopped in the cold long enough to make a short call. Then they went back to the truck, and she drove it out of the garage and through the city center toward the dubious part of town. There was a strong smell of dog food in the air.
"There's a factory here,"
she said. Reacher nodded. "No kidding." She came off a narrow street into some kind of an industrial park and nosed through a tangle of low-built metal structures. There were linoleum dealers and brake shops and places where you could get 4 snow tires for $99 and other places where you could get your steering wheel aligned for $20. On one corner there was a long, low workshop standing on its own in the center of a quarter acre of cracked blacktop. The building had a closed roll-up door and a hand-painted sign that read, "Eddie Brown Engineering." "This is your guy?" Reacher asked. Negley nodded.
"What do we want?"
Reacher shrugged. "No point planning it to death. Something short and something long. One of each, plus some ammunition, I guess. That should do it." She stopped in front of the roll-up door and hit the horn. A guy came out of a personnel entrance and got halfway to the car before he saw who it was. He was tall and heavy through the neck and shoulders. He had short, fair hair and an open, amiable face, but he had big hands and thick wrists and wasn't the sort of guy you'd mess with on a whim. He sketched a wave and ducked back inside, and a moment later the big door started rolling up. Nagley drove in under it, and it came back down behind them. On the inside, the building was about half the size it should have been, but apart from that, it looked convincing. The floor was grease-stained concrete, and there were metal workers' lathes here and there, and drilling machines, and stacks of raw sheet metal and bundles of steel rods. But the back wall was 10 feet closer on the inside than the exterior proportions dictated. Clearly, there was a handsome-sized room concealed behind it.
"This is Eddie Brown," Nagley said.
"Not my real name," the big guy said. He accessed the concealed room by pulling on a big pile of scrap metal. It was all welded together and welded in turn to a steel panel hidden behind it. The whole thing swung open on silent, oiled hinges like a giant three-dimensional door. The guy, calling himself Eddie Brown, led them through it into a whole different situation. The concealed room was as clean as a hospital. It was painted white and lined on all four sides by shelves and racks. On three walls, the shelves held handguns, some of them boxed, some of them loose. The racks were full of long guns, rifles and carbines and shotguns and machine guns, yards of them, all of them neat and parallel. The air was full of the stink of gun oil. The fourth wall was lined like a library with boxes of ammunition. Reacher could smell the new brass and the crisp cardboard and faint traces of powder. "I'm impressed," he said.
"Take what you need," Eddie said.
"Where do the serial numbers lead to?"
"The Austrian army. They kind of fizzle out after that."
10 minutes later, they were back on the road, with Reacher's new jacket carefully spread out in the Yukon's load space over 2 9-millimeter Steyr GBs, a Heckler & Koch MP5 unsilenced machine gun, an M16 rifle, and boxes full of 200 rounds for each weapon. They entered Wyoming after dark, driving north on I-25. They turned left at Cheyenne and picked up I-80. They rolled west to Laramie and then headed north. The town called Grace was still 5 hours away, well beyond Casper. The map showed it nestled in the middle of nowhere between towering mountains on one side and infinite grasslands on the other. "We'll stop in Medicine Bow," Reacher said.
"Sounds like a cool place. We'll aim to get to Grace at dawn tomorrow."
Medicine Bow didn't look like much of a cool place in the dark, but it had a motel about 2 miles out with rooms available. Nagley paid for them. Then they found a steakhouse a mile in the other direction and ate 12-ounce sirloins that cost less than a drink in D.C. The place closed up around them, so they took the hint and headed back to their rooms. Reacher left his coat in the truck to hide the firepower from curious eyes. They said goodnight in the lot. Reacher went straight to bed. He heard Nagley in the shower. She was singing to herself. He could hear it through the wall. He woke up at 4 in the morning, Saturday. Nagley was showering again and still singing. He thought, when the hell does she sleep? He rolled out of bed and headed for the bathroom, turned his shower on hot, which must have made hers run cold, because he heard a muffled scream through the wall. So he turned it off again and waited until he heard her finish. Then he showered and dressed and met her out by the car. It was still pitch dark, still very cold. There were flakes of snow blowing in from the west. They were drifting slowly through the parking lot lights.
"Can't find any coffee," Nagley said.
They found some an hour north. A roadside diner was opening for breakfast. They saw its lights a mile away. It was next to the mouth of a dirt road leading down through the darkness to the Medicine Bow National Forest. The diner looked like a barn, long and low, made out of red boards, cold outside, warm inside. They sat at a table by a curtained window and ate eggs and bacon and toast and drank strong, bitter coffee.
"Okay, we'll call them 1 and 2, Nagley said. "1 is the Bismarck guy. You'll recognize him. 2 is the guy from the garage video. We might recognize him from his build, but we don't really know what he looks like."
Reacher nodded. "So we'll look for the Bismarck guy hanging out with some other guy. No point planning it to death."
You don't sound very enthusiastic.
You should go home.
Now that I've gotten you here?
I've got a bad feeling about this.
You're uptight that Froelich was killed, that's all. Doesn't mean anything's going to happen to me.
He said nothing.
We're two against two, Nagley said. You and me against two bozos, and you're worried about it?
Not very.
Maybe they won't even show. Bannon figured they'd know it was a trap.
They'll show, Reacher said. They've been challenged. It's a testosterone thing. And they've got more than enough screws loose to jump right on it.
Nothing's going to happen to me if they do.
I'd feel bad if it did.
It's not going to.
Tell me I'm not making you do this.
My own free will.
He nodded. So let's go. They got back on the road. Snowflakes hung in the headlight beams. They drifted in weightlessly from the west and shone bright in the light and then whipped backward as they drove. They were big flakes, dry and powdery, not many of them. The road was narrow. It wandered left and right. The surface was lumpy. All around it in the darkness was a vastness so large it sucked the noise of the car away into nothing. They were driving in a bright tunnel of silence, leaping ahead from one lonely snowflake to the next.
I guess Casper will have a police department, Reacher said.
Nagley nodded at the wheel.
Could be 100 strong. Casper is nearly as big as Cheyenne. Nearly as big as Bismarck, actually.
And they'll be responsible for Grace, Reacher said.
Alongside the state troopers, I guess.
So any other cops we find there are our guys.
You're still certain they're cops?
He nodded. It's the only way everything makes sense. The initial contact with Nendick and Andretti in the cop bars, the familiarity with the NCIC, the access to the government weapons, plus the way they slip in and out everywhere. Crowds, confusion, a gold shield gets you anywhere. And if Armstrong's right and their dad was a cop, that's a pretty good predictor. It's a family trade like the military.
My dad wasn't in the military.
But mine was. So there's 50% right away. Better than most other professions. And you know what the clincher is?
What?
Something we should have figured long ago. But we just skated right on by. We missed it, totally. The two dead Armstrongs. How the hell do you just find two white guys with fair hair and blue eyes and the right dates of birth and the right faces and above all the right first and last names? That's a very tall order. But these guys did it. And there's only one practical way of doing it, which is the National DMV database. Driver's license information, names, addresses, dates of birth, photographs, it's all right there, everything you need. And nobody can get into it except cops, who can dial it right up. Nagley was silent for a moment.
Okay, they are cops.
They sure are. And we're brain dead for not spotting it on Tuesday.
But cops would have heard of Armstrong long ago, wouldn't they?
Why would they? Cops know about their own little world, that's all, same as anybody else. If you worked in some rural police department in Maine or Florida or outside San Diego, you might know the New York Giants quarterback or the Chicago White Sox center fielder, but there's no reason why you would have heard of North Dakota's junior senator, unless you were a politics junkie, and most people aren't. Nagley drove on. Way to the right. Far to the east, a narrow band of sky was a fraction lighter than it had been. It had turned the color of dark charcoal against the blackness beyond it. The snow was no heavier, no lighter. The big lazy flakes drifted in from the mountains, floating level, sometimes rising.
So which is it? She asked. Maine, or Florida, or San Diego? We need to know, because if they're flying in, they won't be armed with anything they can't pick up here.
California is a possibility. Oregon isn't. They wouldn't have revealed their specific identity to Armstrong if they still lived in Oregon. Nevada is a possibility. Or Utah. Or Idaho. Anywhere else is too far.
For what?
To be on a reasonable radius from Sacramento. How long does a stolen cooler of ice last? Nagley said nothing. Nevada or Utah or Idaho, Reacher said. That's my guess. Not California. I think they wanted a state line between them and the place they went for the thumb. Feels better, psychologically. I think they're a long day's drive from Sacramento, which means They're probably a long day's drive from here, too, in the other direction. So I think they'll be coming in by road, armed to the teeth.
When?
Today, if they've got any sense.